Everybody all set? All righty. You guys ready? Okay. We're now reconvened for the admin portion of the meeting. We have an item on consent. I move passage of that.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Sensing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, signify by saying nay. Motion is approved.
Thank you, Steve. Okay, into discussion. I want to thank Victor for his work on this first one. This regional haze stuff has been, well, it was triggered by a couple of things going on in MISO as related to a different EPA rule. And then we kind of engaged in this with our with Lignite Energy Council, et cetera, to find out where North Dakota is with its regional haze rule. And Victor has this summary of the state's SIP, and I guess we wanted to get his insights on that and then talk about whether or not we should be filing comments with the state in relation to its state implementation plan or SIP. So, Victor, thoughts?
Yeah, so the Department of Environmental Quality, per EPA, regional haze rules requires North Dakota to submit a state implementation plan. They have developed a tentative plan that they're currently taking public comments on. The executive summary should have been included in your meeting materials for this meeting. We've reached out to Otter Tail and MDU, the two kind of affected utilities that we regulate. They're intending to file joint comments as owners of Coyote. And they have it committed to, but we expect to receive those comments from them once they are filed. If you want to use those as a guideline in any way. There's a meeting, I believe it's June 2nd, if my memory is serving me correctly, that the Department of Environmental Quality will hold to take public comments and further discussion on the matter. I think that is up in, I'm trying to recall if it's Beulah or Underwood. It's not in Bismarck. It's closer to the sites of these things. So we would certainly be able to submit comments if that's something the commission is interested in doing.
Submit or participate?
Yeah, well, or participate both. May be challenging since we have a rate case hearing scheduled on that date.
Oh, yeah. Yes, we do.
So likely most of our key staff will be here, including commissioners. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I did make an attempt to see what other people are saying. They don't have a public kind of repository of the comments that have been filed. They just have a methodology to submit them. So I'm sure they'll be publicly available at some point. I just was not able to locate any of those comments to kind of guide our thought process.
Did the utilities give you any indication when they thought they were going to have their comments prepared?
They didn't.
What's the debt? So there's that hearing on the 2nd, but when is the deadline for submitting comments?
I'm trying to recall. I feel like June 1st? Okay. That's what my thought was. I just...
My sense in talking with Lignite Energy Council is they're very supportive of the SIP as proposed by the health department, and are concerned that it might be overturned by EPA and then there'd be a federal implementation plan. And so I mean, my initial pretty strong desire is that we do engage and submit comments on behalf of the importance of this unit, Kyle, for our utilities, our ratepayers, and for the MISO region as a whole, which is currently in a capacity shortfall for the summer. And so I think we I don't think we need, you know, really long, exhaustive comments about a lot of technical things. I think we just should comment from a standpoint of reliability and affordability. This unit, Coyote, is needed. Now would not be the time for an EPA regulation to further exacerbate the retirements that are occurring in the MISO region, the 15-state MISO region, and contribute to additional shortages of capacity that we have to keep this and others on board. So that would be kind of the sense of the comments that I think that would be appropriate from our agency and would like to see us do jointly if possible.
I would concur. I think this is an opportunity for us to add comments that the concern of federal regulations that might be coming down and costly for the Coyote Station and also for tax consumers. So I would hope that we could prepare comments.
I think you've summed it up pretty well. The question is then, are we going to, has staff heard enough to kind of prepare an initial draft for a review? Do you want to schedule a work session to go through them? Or just each submit our own response to their initial draft at first? I guess with a pretty short time frame here. Now the question is, how do we proceed? Because it sounds like we all agree that we should.
What would you guys prefer?
I guess I would prefer to have with one individual commissioner. I mean, largely due to that June 6th deadline is really short.
June 1st.
Yeah, we'll definitely.
Does it need to be long and complicated though, Jack?
Sure. You're telling a lawyer that. It always will be long and complicated if you allow me to write it. But still, with that in mind, it does have a tendency to get a little mixed up when we have three people trying to draft a letter. I think we have good direction from the three of you. So if you are comfortable as a body, we'd prefer probably to work with one commissioner on this.
I'm good with that. Okay. I'm very good with that. And it can be you, Randy, or me as chair, or Sherry as, we all have kind of...
I guess I would have the recommendation for you, Commissioner Fedorchak, just because of the concern going on with MISO, too, and the impact there. So thanks, Julie, for stepping in.
The plan would be for all of us to sign it, though.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if we work on something together with Jack, and I'll make sure that we keep it short and simple, then... We can have a draft out to everybody, and then if we feel like we need a work session, we could create one.
Yeah, it'd be nice if we had maybe a couple days to review, just in case something gets by you that one of us feels dramatically about, but not to nitpick any small detail. Sure.
So just keep in mind, the 2nd is next Thursday. Well, so
the deadline
is Monday.
It's the first.
Wednesday. Yeah, so the deadline is, okay, so
and,
that's Wednesday.
And Monday is a holiday.
Yeah, so there isn't going to be a couple days.
Yeah.
Let's shoot for... A
few hours?
Yeah. We'll get it to you. Well, let's see, today is Wednesday. And I can talk with Jack, but I might be able to draft the first draft. And then Jack can legalize it. And then... We can maybe have something by Friday to you guys for review, and then we can wrap it up next week, Tuesday.
I think even if we got it Tuesday.
Okay. All right. Yeah, tomorrow. Okay. Does that work? That time
works. Thanks, Julie, for stepping up and doing that draft.
Sure. Not a problem. Gives me a chance to write something I don't get to do very often.
Little kind of side note there, the other one you had kind of referenced, Julie, was the good neighbor rule. I don't have the details from Excel yet. They will be sending those out to me, and I will pass them along to you as well. So when we talked about the regional haze rules with Excel, they referenced the good neighbor rule is actually a worse thing as far as we're concerned here in Minnesota. So we anticipate some impacts to that. I have looked up Minnesota, what they were assigned from the EPA on this good neighbor rule. And there's kind of allowances in all of this, you know. So in 2023, it looks like they have to start reducing their emissions of, I believe it's nitrous oxide. But there's an allowance for up to, I think it was 120% of the allowance that you can kind of fudge around. So if you add that in, 2023, they could actually emit more than they were, than what their baseline was. 2024 is the same objective, so again, they can emit more. 2025, they move down a slight amount in their proposed budget, but again, with the allowance, more than in the past. 2026 is really the first year where there's some concern level, but knowing what Xcel's plans are, I'm assuming that's really not going to be an issue there. You know, they have some coal units that are already slated to retire next year and in 2026. Right? North Dakota's not on board with such things, but...
Well, that's interesting because Carrie Hansler was the one who said they're very opposed to this and are urging MISO to even get on board in filing comments and concerns about that. And MISO, in a call yesterday, said they are going to file comments and concerns, even though a Minnesota staffer said that they shouldn't. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out in Minnesota with Xcel.
So I'll see what their summary says and kind of take a look at how that all plays out. But
yeah. So the good neighbor rule is similar but different. It doesn't apply to North Dakota's units here. But it's also a new, pretty onerous EPA regulation targeted at basically coal, and would potentially lead to more early retirements of coal units to meet the regulatory thresholds that they're setting. And again, MISO is going to, they said yesterday, they're going to file comments from a concern on the transition and the speed of their retirements and not having enough new capacity to back it up and keep the grid reliable. So when we get more information from Xcel on that one, we'll probably have a conversation with them about it, just because I think it's important for us to understand what they're saying and what their impact is on their units.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Victor.
Thank you.
More fun that just keeps falling in our laps. Decommissioned wind facilities. Adam, you're on board for this one, it looks like. Oh yeah, this one. That's what this is all about. That's right. So, I don't know if you guys have the back, but so Adam sent around that memo,
yes,
which I thought was really great, but I wasn't able to understand, like I couldn't put the pictures and the text and everything together, and I just thought because it was such a big conversation here and a big consideration for this felling method that we actually have this real live example of somebody using it, so I thought we should take the extra time to make sure we understand how it went and ask questions for you guys who was on site. So Adam's going to share with us his experiences on the site.
Thank you. So if you recall, I visited the Minot Wind site in which they were in the process of decommissioning two wind facilities. They went COD in 2002, so they're approximately 20 years old. They're also 60 meters in height, so they're relatively, they're not very big structures to decommission. So on March 3rd of this year, we received notice that they were planning to decommission these facilities. These are two 1.3 megawatt turbines. On March 18th, commission staff visited the facilities, and they decommissioned these facilities using the felling approach, in which they cut the base of the hub with an acetylene torch and hooked up a couple of very large ropes and pulled it to the ground and then decommissioned it by cutting it up in manageable pieces and disposing of it or sending it to a recycling facility. So you can see from picture one here is where they made the cut with the acetylene torch. They cut it in such a way that when they pull it with the ropes, it actually falls in the direction that they want it. In this one is actually the one that they felled with the blades up. In other words, the generator itself made impact on the surface initially versus the other way around, in which you can fell it with blades down, which provides more stability. Because if you kind of imagine a big center of gravity piece that weighs tons and tons, first impacting, what happens is you might get one blade that hits the ground and then kind of moves it over, such that the preferred way to fell these things would be blades down. And that kind of also spreads the weight a little more uniformly.
How are the, I can't picture this, the blades up versus down. That doesn't make sense. Because they're all, they're out. So like up versus down, what?
Yeah, so
down,
then,
what?
So if you imagine, I don't know if, I think there might be a picture.
Imagine your own fan.
Yeah.
Going back versus down.
So like the,
so
the
in other words,
blades are out here and here's the nacelle or whatever
it's
called.
Yeah, yeah. In the nacelle,
this
there's,
would be,
right. So you have the blades here and then the nacelle here.
Yeah.
So it would go like this versus like that.
I got it.
Yeah.
Okay,
so picture one is the where they made the cut. Let's see. You can kind of see it from a distance here in the, to the right. You can kind of see how that, it's like a divot thing or whatnot.
Sure.
So they felled one site with a structure, as I said, hitting the ground blades down, which is what I call site one. But first, let's see, this is a picture of the machine that they used to pull it down. This was actually built by Suzlon. If you recall, initially in the early 2000s, they had a problem with their blades. So they designed this to manage their warranty work, in which this machine was actually designed to take the blade and then push it all the way up to the nacelle rather than have a crane. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
It's that blue and yellow machine right there?
Right, yep. That's what they used to pull the structure to the surface. Yeah, ropes or
cables.
So this is picture four. So this is site one. So this had completed decommissioning the entire turbine with only the foundation and underground cables remaining. You can tell that the site was disturbed by a lot of heavy traversing throughout the area.
How deep is that hole? It looks like a big hole to me. Is that accurate or not?
No, it's there is one hole here that I can get to. Here, these are just tire marks, and what had happened is, let's see,
the frost.
Yeah, the frost. The contractor had indicated to staff that when they came here, the area had experienced its first warm days, and the frost came down approximately 4 inches.
Yeah.
So they were already out here, so that's why the site looks kind of messed up. Right. So it caught them by surprise because they were halfway through the decommissioning.
Yeah.
And that's why the site is pretty muddy there. Now, a few locations, one of the commission's concern was fiberglass and whether it breaks in pieces or it kind of pulverizes into kind of dust. And you could tell that in some cases in this site, even though it was difficult to determine because there's so much mud there, that there were a few pieces of fiberglass still lodged in the mud. However, this wasn't a huge concern. I think that they could rectify it, but then again, they weren't finished with the decommissioning.
A couple questions regarding that. Mm-hmm. Number one, how would they rectify it? And the other thing you and I talked about was the shattering on how big of an area they would review without knowing how far things would shatter.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I did is, I went out and walked, the area until I couldn't see any more fiberglass. There was a fiberglass, I didn't have a tape measure or anything, I couldn't tell the distance, exactly, but I would probably say maybe there was an area from the center of the nacelle, out to the farm field, maybe. I would say between 70 to 100 feet. There was still some fiberglass there, but that was in a dry part of a field. After that, I didn't see any evidence of fiberglass. And then, let's see, a couple more pictures of... this is the area that I'm referencing here. There was a little bit of fiberglass in this dry part here, and this is about 100 feet, 80 to 100 feet away from the center of impact. And then another picture of the site.
That white stuff is all fiberglass, not snow.
I think that's probably a reflection from the water. Yeah, it's just mud. Yeah.
Mud.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mud and water.
Mud and water.
Yep. So this is the impact right here. It's approximately 8 feet in diameter where the nacelle made
impact.
And
that's blades down.
This is blades down, yep.
Yep.
This was, you can't tell, but the depth of this is approximately 3 feet. And that's another picture of point of impact. So this is the second site. They were in the process of decommissioning this site. This did not experience the same issue with the muddy conditions as site number one. The site was on a bluff, so they couldn't yaw the blades in such a way that they could fell it with the blades down. So therefore, they had to fell it, since they're on a top of a bluff, with the blades up.
Did the tower fall down onto, down the hill, or did they find a flat stop spot for the tower to fall?
A portion of it, they told me that a portion of it actually got away from them a little bit and slid down the hill a little bit. But I did not see that, or because they had already cleaned that up.
Okay.
And a good bulk of it up. But yeah, because of that stability problem, that a portion of it did, because on the other side of that is kind of another steep decline. So that was an issue for them. So this is a picture of the site that with the equipment that was remaining. You can tell it's relatively free from fiberglass. You could probably just rake up what was remaining.
So was there less fiberglass spread with the blades up?
It was tough to tell because you'd have to go through all that mud and figure out, what was still there and left behind.
Did they offer any insights? the company?
No, they didn't. Other than the contractor, in subsequent conversations, indicated that it wasn't a big issue, and that any kind of issue would be easily rectified with the landowner.
In follow-up to Julie's question, your second to your last paragraph, the contractor did indicate to the staff that the preferred method of failing is to fall the turbine blades down.
Right.
Seems
ridiculous.
Yeah.
Cause more breakage, yep. But I'm curious why.
Yeah. It's kind of tough to tell between one site and another based on the fact that the first site was, it was such a disaster. Not disaster. It was muddy, I should say. I shouldn't say a disaster.
On the plan that we approved, weren't they taking the blades off?
Yeah, I looked at that, and I forget what language that they used, but they didn't indicate reverse disassembly of any type, but they also didn't indicate felling. And when I was talking to Basin about maybe a month, when they announced this, or even maybe like a week prior, I forget when it was, they had indicated that they were mobilizing a crane. So based on that first conversation, I was still under the assumption that they were going to, take them apart and use a crane. And I think that would likely have been what was going through, their head as well.
I thought, but I'd have to go back and look, that the plan we approved, one of the accommodations they made to reduce the fiberglass issue was to take the blades off first.
That was a different case on that basin.
Right. Yeah, on the one that we approved.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, Tatanka. Yeah, right. Yeah, so Tatanka, they plan on... There's a truck-mounted crane that they're going to use to first take off the blades.
Okay. So this, on that case, this issue of blades up or blades down, or the fiberglass issue
from the
blades shouldn't be...
Shouldn't be an issue.
Yeah. I mean, they can always change their plan.
Right.
I mean, Basin changed their plan.
Yep.
Okay.
We're on 12. Let's see. This is another picture of what was remaining. You'll see that's the rotor and drive shaft there, along with some of the blades. This is another picture of the site. So this is where the nacelle made impact. You can't tell it, but the generator is actually lodged in the ground, and the contractor actually estimated the depth to be 6 feet. And this is another picture just showing how, if you take a look at the rotor and drive shaft, how far, it is a good distance away from where the center made impact. And that kind of has to, kind of gets wobbly, is kind of what I heard from the contractor when they can't yaw it such that it doesn't fall blades down, but blades up.
Okay.
And that is... So that's it. Kind of in summary, it seemed like the fiberglass blades didn't pulverize. There still was some remaining cleanup to be done. So I think, my concern there was largely mitigated.
Good. All right. Thank you, Adam.
Yep.
Any other questions for Adam?
Good. What happened to the hub? Was there any breakage there, or does it just lay down on the ground and it's fine?
Yeah, it's just lays down. Yeah. So there's no breakage there.
Okay. Yep. I guess my just one comment on besides that question on your review. A, thanks for going in a hurry. Mm-hmm. But, so this was a wind farm consisting of two turbines. So as we approve these for more substantial wind farms, where there's 75 or 100, and really besides the mess that we see of mud being torn around from working, as far as compaction issues or things, even cleanup caused by breakage, probably couldn't have better conditions than that the ground is largely frozen, but you had a couple warm days, and so there's a few inches of soft padding right on top of it. Where that generator is pushed 6 feet into the ground, imagine outside the top few inches, most of that ground is frozen. What's it going to do in the summer when one of these is 75 or 100 turbines, and you don't get, you know, 1 or 2 days of probably the best weather imaginable for this, where A, we don't have snow like on a normal winter, B, the ground is still substantially froze, but C, it just melted a little bit and provided a few inches of padding on top. I'm still very concerned about this process, but thank you for the inspection.
Those are good points, Randy, and this is really valuable insight, so thank you, Adam, for collecting this data and doing the search. It almost makes me think that actually winter decommissioning might be better if there is snow, and it might be worth considering a requirement for the felling method to be done when the ground is frozen. So it's just a good lesson learned that we wouldn't have had if we hadn't.
The biggest impact you're going to have there is because all the workers are outside, then you're going to have to watch the temperature and what equipment is needed to get to it. So I would agree.
Yeah.
But the winter conditions in North Dakota could be very deadly, and with the majority of the work being outside.
Yeah. And I think I agree that it certainly seems like the best time, but then if there's a bunch of snow, you don't see white fiberglass, and by the time the snow melts, how much of that is blown around over to the neighbors? And,
well, if they're taking the blades off, there shouldn't be much white fiberglass.
There certainly should be a lot if they're taking the blades off.
What else has fiberglass besides the blades?
That would be it.
Yeah, so I think that that's one of the important differences between what we approved and this.
There could be some of the panels, I mean, depending on the manufacturer of the turbine, some of the side panels of the cell potentially could be fiberglass.
Sure. Okay, any other questions or discussion on this piece? Amy, you could certainly ask questions too if you want. All right.
I just want to thank Adam. I know you and I talked about this several times, and your work going out there and getting the pictures and stuff and the report. So thank you for your work.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, the contractor was great to deal with.
Good.
So, yeah. Very so good. He was able to get us out on site. So.
Sweet. All right, moving on then. Looks like Jonathan is next on our list to talk about the response to Clyde Eisenbeth's Jonathan and Jack.
Sure. Would you like to just hop in?
Yeah, you can hop in. Jack has more experience with this issue than I do, so.
Well, this is an issue that began even before I started working on this issue.
Gift that keeps on giving.
Right. So we first received, I think, some filings back in 2018 from Mr. Eisenbeiss, and the Reclamation Division provided him a response to all his concerns and the issues that he raised. Then he filed a subsequent filing in 2019, and he cited a number of different procedural administrative code as well as statute of how he wanted to proceed. And what we did at that point in time is we used probably the next step of escalation of the ones that he cited, which was an informal review of a response by the commission. The Reclamation Division did provide an updated response to every single one of the issues he presented. And then Commissioner Crispin and Commissioner Fedorchuk, I'm sure you both recall the discussion that ensued. And the commission then agreed with the Reclamation Division. Their assessment on the matter. So after that, what we did was we left in a response to the future possible procedural openings that he could take, including the citizen suit, and subsequently he could file a formal complaint, which I think we even verbally told him if he just refiled this stuff at this point, we would consider it. That's the next step of escalation, which would be the formal review from the commission. We didn't receive anything from him for besides general correspondence and emails back and forth, usually requesting information, and which we were more than happy to give him. I know on, I think last Thursday or Friday, that he hand provided a letter to the three of you, which of course then staff was able to get a copy of as well. And in his request, he gave provided, I guess, previous filings. This is all correspondence that we've received before. Generally the same information that you could find if you actually went into our docket. And then asked for an informal meeting with you. Now, generally that hasn't happened in the past, largely due to the fact that it allows one party in a complaint setting to essentially present a case without the opportunity for the other party or the respondent to provide any sort of cross or, you know, response to the matter. And so what the Reclamation Division was suggesting was just providing him a response saying, well, if you would like to have an audience with the commission, the next step would probably be a formal review of it, which is essentially a formal hearing, which he had concerns about having an attorney there, which he's not required to have one. He could actually present the case to you directly as well and specify that and probably provide them the citations of how to subsequently proceed as well. The Reclamation Division was hoping to provide that letter later in the week. Jonathan, is that correct? I think the discussion was Friday, I just was going to provide that to the commission for direction, whether you guys are comfortable with that or whether you'd like to take a different avenue.
I like the direction that you're going on it.
Okay.
The letter will be, who's going to sign off on that?
It would be the director, so it would be Xander Brinkman.
Okay, and that's going to explain to him again that the next step would be formal hearing, and right. He just needs to let us know if he wants that.
Yep, absolutely. And
set a date.
Commissioner Christman, that's correct. And also we'll probably provide that even upon the closure of the case, there's still the OSM review.
There's still the what?
He still would have the opportunity for the Office of Surface and Mine to review our findings.
And in that formal hearing, then that would be a situation where the company is also able to participate.
Yep, it would be, it would operate administratively just like most of our hearings. So he'd be able to go up there, present evidence. There would be the opportunity for, of course, rebuttal evidence to make sure that we have a full record to make a decision upon, rather than just, you know, one side worth of documents.
And the letter will make clear to him again that formal review, like with a judicial court proceeding, he may be represented by an attorney, but he also may do it himself, correct?
Commissioner Christman, that is correct. And also I was going to suggest that as well that we have the Reclamation Director, of course, provide you the copy as a portfolio holder if the other commissioners are agreeable to you having final sign-off on it.
Okay.
I think that's a good approach, and I think it's a couple things. I would encourage the letter to be simple and clear.
Sure.
And decisive, because this has gone back to 2018. That's 4 years. There was a lot of time and effort put into the initial response, and a lot of back and forth since then. And we need to wrap this up. I mean, there needs to be a conclusion to this. And so the formal hearing is the established process. It's been in existence for many, many years. We have to stick to our established processes. Because we're an administrative agency and we don't just create new processes because for each and everything. We have them established and we follow them because they're fair and they work. So I think it's like, keep it simple. Here's the option, this formal process, here's how you do it. Include the form that outlines how it's done. And then I also think the next step, and I don't know, Randy, how you feel about this, but I don't like this being open-ended for forever. I think that if he chooses not to do a formal process by some point, then we need to close this case. And then if he chooses to proceed after that, it goes to OSM to review what we've already done. Because, you know, we've got a small staff, everyone's busy, there's a lot of things going on. We have to be responsive, we have to address it, but at some point there has to be closure. And then he can go on to the next level to get what he's looking for if he's not satisfied with what he gets through us. So I think we need to have that other piece in there that we're going to close this case at such and such a time if we don't hear otherwise that we're moving to the formal process.
Great. And Commissioner Haugenhofer, I'll make sure that I also sit down with you and get you up to speed with the previous filings and where to find them and what was contained in them as well.
I would appreciate that, but I'm just going to echo what Julie said, is that somehow we have to close it, that this is your option. If you choose that, if you choose not to do that, it's closed. But if he pursues it, then what the next step is.
Sure, yep.
I appreciate staff's time in this. Thank you.
And Mr. Emmer, do you have anything else?
No.
Okay, thank you.
All right. All righty, so that's that on the response. So then we have to go to scheduling, and I took my phone into my office, so I have to go grab that before we can. I can be very effective on scheduling.
New Commissioner Bronner.
Bonus point.
Julie, we've got it covered. Pam's going to put it on the schedule.
Oh, really? Well, I guess I may or may not be there.
Hopefully we have a quorum.
No, that's no fun, Pamela. Okay, Victor, what are we looking at for this?
So we just need about an hour and a half, 2 hours max, I would say, if we can budget 2 hours. This is just a standard. We do informals for new ETC applications when we're requesting lifeline designation. It's not concerning in any way. We've just always done it this way.
And what's the time frame? How soon do they want this?
So as soon as possible is what they've requested, and they specifically said they will make anything work.
No pressure here.
And the challenge we have is the next available informal date on our calendar is out into like September.
Really?
Because we utilized our informal slots for cybersecurity meetings.
Oh.
I don't recall. I don't recall who did that.
Jeez. Just very innovative, efficient person. Okay, so we're looking into, I'm looking at the first week of June, like the 6th, 7th, and 8th. Is there anything that week?
Oh, yeah. We have a hearing on Monday, the 6th, don't we?
Yes, that's
yeah.
Well, where are these people from? They might need a little more time than that.
I believe they're planning to attend remotely.
Okay.
Okay, so SP 7th is out.
The 7th is out. The 8th, I think, is a commission meeting day.
And what do we have during the informal that day?
We are trying to still schedule something for Pat.
Oh, good.
We don't have any confirmation
but
on that date yet.
I would say that couldn't that be at 3 or 3:30? I'd almost prefer to have that a little later in the day.
We certainly could.
And then...
So, yeah, we
and
we,
then
I
we'd
mean,
have... An informal time
I think that
there.
Would be very odd. I mean, I don't think we have anything else. No. So we could do 1:30 June 8th for this.
And then 3:30 for Pat.
Right. If we're able to make the Pat thing happen.
Yeah.
On the 8th, sorry.
on the 8th.
If we do that, and I don't object to it, this isn't something that I think we're going to be doing a lot of scrambling, or staff is going to be doing a lot of scrambling right before it. I wonder if we could start at 1 already instead of 1:30.
Sure.
And just leave ourselves a little bit of room.
Sure. Yeah. I typically love our policy at 1:30 meetings and have a small celebration every time. But I agree that it's on that day it would be good. So I think we can make that an exception to that practice. So 1 o'clock, informal on this Air Voice Wireless.
On June 8th.
And then if Pat's thing can be worked out, we could do that at 3 or 3:30.
Yep.
And I would say most likely it's not going to happen for Pat.
Yeah.
I think this is what we had, didn't we, Pam, to put on the calendar when they stepped out? Yeah.
Okay. Then we're done with that. Director's meeting. Why am I responsible for that, Steve?
You were the one that actually requested that one.
Well, I have my list of items for that in a different file in my office, but there's a number of things to talk about with the directors. So the last time we had one scheduled, it got overrun by our work on some other things, so we need to reschedule that. So let's...
Well, what about that next day after what we just scheduled on the on June 9th? I see there's possible budget discussion in the morning and then the LEC quarterly meeting. But those are usually over by 2:30 or something like that. So what if we schedule this director's meeting at 3 o'clock on that Thursday?
I have the Energy Hawks coming here at 3:30.
Oh, okay.
But what about in the morning? We've got the budget discussion starting at 9, and we could potentially start that at 8:30 and add something at like 10:30 or 11.
I don't know what all you have planned for the director's meeting, how much time it will be like that.
I mean, 10:30 would be enough.
Oh, yeah.
More than enough. It might just need to be an hour.
Yeah.
So the 9th at 10:30. And then we'd need to move the budget discussion a little earlier, I think.
Okay.
Is that for everybody, that budget discussion? Yes. I think so. Okay.
So 10:30, June 9th?
Yeah.
And budget meeting starting at?
8:30 instead of 9. Is that one with all of us? Maybe that isn't all commission. Yeah, it is. Okay, 8:30. And then 10:30, director's meeting. Okay. All right. That wasn't so bad, Pamela. I don't know why you struggled so much with it. I know. There might be a little bit of a break. That next week gets ugly, though, for like a week and a half after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I think that's it. Are we adjourned? Anybody?